Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, last night we began our look at wisdom in the Old Testament in an odd place, the book of Ecclesiastes. And the message of the book of Ecclesiastes is, as long as you stay under the sun, life is difficult, and then you die. And so the second wise man we saw at the end, as he's evaluating the teaching of Qohelet to his son, urges him to an above-the-sun perspective, fear God, obey the commandments, and live in the light of the coming judgment. Now, this morning, we turn our attention to the book of Proverbs. And Proverbs is the place where we go in the Old Testament to come to a deeper understanding of the biblical concept of wisdom, because that's the purpose of the book. As you can see, if you turn to the preface of the book in the first seven verses. Now, I'm going to read the first six verses to start, and then save the seventh verse for a moment. The first verse is the superscription announcing that these are the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. But the next six verses are giving us the purpose of the book. Now, you know, these biblical books are not unique in terms of their genre in the ancient Near East. There are about 40 ancient Egyptian proverb collections and Sumerian proverb collections, and they also start with this kind of preface, which announces its intention. For gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction and prudent behavior, for doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young, let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance for understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. Okay, so a couple of things about these verses before going on to verse 7. First of all, notice who this book is addressed to. Now, a lot of the book, just like the book of Ecclesiastes, is a father speaking to his son. But the preface broadens the audience to include everybody in the covenant community, not just the young and immature, but also those who are already wise. So everybody has something to gain from this book. And it is the purpose of this book to impart wisdom, which is in Hebrew, chokmah. You got to get that guttural H sound in there. It's like a camel spinning. Chokmah. And so what is chokmah? Well, on the first level, I would say it's a very practical category and can be distinguished from, you know, intelligence. That is, whereas IQ measures the acquisition of facts, wisdom is more a skill of living. It's a very practical category. Indeed, it's very similar to what is commonly talked about today over the past 20, 25 years as emotional intelligence. You probably all heard that term at some point or another. Emotional intelligence. It was made popular by a book by Dan Goldman of that name about 25 years ago. You know, before that, we called it maybe social skills. And some of you have probably seen a very popular book that I think is really very insightful and helpful by David Brooks called The Social Animal. And both Goldman and Brooks talks about how important it is to be able to navigate life, to know how to say the right thing at the right time, how to do the right thing that's appropriate for the situation, how to express the right emotion at the right level. So it's kind of a skill of living. Now, what was particularly interesting about Goldman's book is that it was based on studies by sociologists and psychologists. And what they pointed out was that there was a high correlation between a high, what he called EQ, and success in life. Success being defined as having good, rich relationships with other people by getting a job and keeping it. And the surprising fact, at least to me as an academic, who always encourages kids and students to do the best on their tests and get straight A's, because that would be the key to success, he pointed out that there's a low correlation between a high IQ and those same things. Now, I know I'm speaking to a group with a very high IQ, so I want to be quick to point out, you can have a high IQ. You can have a high IQ and a high EQ, all right? So they're not mutually exclusive. I mean, I even think of my field, which is the college professorate, which is where an awful lot of people used to go who had a high IQ and a low EQ. But unless you're teaching at Harvard or Stanford or something, and if you are a professor, your graduate students are teaching the students, you actually have to be somewhat appreciated by your students these days. So when we do hiring, we do look for people with high professional skills, the ability to teach and do research. But the way we used to put it when we were hiring at my old seminary, Westminster Theological Seminary, when we hired some of the Old Testament department, the third and also essential criterion was, do we want to have a beer with that person? Okay, that was essential. They didn't have to drink beer, though it was a Reformed seminary in Presbyterian with Dutch Reformed background. They could drink a Coke, but did we want to have a beer with them? So that was our EQ question. The book of Proverbs is a book that wants to help us grow in our EQ. It wants to help us know how to say the right thing at the right time, to do the right thing at the right time, to not get carried away by our emotions so we undermine ourselves. And the book is filled with that kind of practical advice. But if we just define wisdom on that level, we would certainly be shortchanging the concept. There's also an ethical quality to it. It's not just say the right thing at the right time, even if it's not true, to get the best thing out of the best out of the situation you can. It's not teaching you how to deceive people. Notice, indeed, in that introductory section, it's verse 3, the second part, doing what is right and just and fair. So as you read through Proverbs, you see it's not just practical advice, it's also ethical advice. Now, two, if we keep it just there, we're shortchanging the concept of wisdom. And an awful lot of people, including scholars, keep it right there. Sometimes you'll hear people talk about Proverbs as if it's just some kind of self-help book, that it really doesn't have any kind of theological significance. One German scholar in the mid-20th century, Walter Eichgroth, called it a secular book or a humanistic book. Far from it. And here's where verse 7 comes to play. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. That's a pretty surprising statement in a lot of ways. First of all, it's the beginning of wisdom. It's saying you can't even get to square one with the wisdom task unless you have a proper relationship with God. And that proper relationship with God is defined as having fear of the Lord. Now, especially for a modern 21st century audience, that seems surprising, and Christians' minds might go immediately to 1 John and say, perfect love casts out fear. Well, not this type of fear. And the New Testament also advocates, if you do a concordance search on fear, you'll find plenty of passages in the New Testament where the encouragement is to have a proper fear of God. Now, one of the problems, I think, is, you know, no two languages line up perfectly with each other. We've talked about linguistics at another time, but so there isn't an English word that gets exactly at what this Hebrew word yirat means. But respect is much too weak, and there's some translations in the 60s, like the Old Living Bible, which translated it, respect for the Lord, just too milquetoast, too weak. That's not really capturing it. On the other hand, of course, this is not the type of fear that makes one run away. This is the kind of fear which expresses an acknowledgement that you are a creature standing before your Creator, that you are an inferior before a superior. And it's the kind of fear that cultivates humility. Now, as you read through Proverbs, that, of course, is a paramount virtue, humility, as opposed to pride, often expressed as being wise in your own eyes. So why is fear important? Fear is the kind of attitude that makes you listen to that person. It acknowledges that you are benefited by listening to the speaker, who is, on one instance, God, and God is speaking through the Father to the Son. Now, this truth is taught in another very interesting way. And remember that my purpose in my talks is to kind of orient you to these books so they become resources for your own further study. So I want to explore for a moment the figure of woman wisdom in Proverbs 1 through 9. Who is this woman? Who is woman wisdom? She's found in the first part of the book of Proverbs. Proverbs can be divided into two big parts. Proverbs 1 through 9, which are lectures or discourses, mostly of a father to a son, but also of a woman named Wisdom to all the men. And then Proverbs 10 and following are the Proverbs per se, those short, pithy admonitions, prohibitions, and so forth, observations. And that's what we usually associate with the book of Proverbs. Well, I want to explore this picture of woman wisdom, who appears for the first time in the second lecture of chapter 1, beginning in verse 20. Out in the open, wisdom calls aloud. She raises her voice in the public square. On top of the wall, she cries out. At the city gate, she makes her speech. How long will you who are simple love your simple ways? How long will mockers delight in mockery and fools hate knowledge? Repent at my rebuke. Then I will pour out my thoughts to you. I will make known to you my teachings. But since you refuse to listen when I call and no one pays attention when I stretch out my hand, since you disregard all my advice and do not accept my rebuke, I in turn will laugh when disaster strikes you. I will mock when calamity overtakes you, when calamity overtakes you like a storm, when disaster sweeps over you like a whirlwind, when distress and trouble overwhelm you. Then they will call to me, but I will not answer. They will look for me, but will not find me. Since they hated knowledge and did not choose to fear the Lord, since they would not accept my advice and spurned my rebuke, they will eat the fruit of their ways and be filled with the fruit of their schemes. For the waywardness of the simple will destroy them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will live in safety and be at ease without fear of harm. The first thing that should strike you is that this is one tough woman. But their toughness is in the context of wanting to develop a relationship with us. We are the men. When you read the book of Proverbs, you put yourself in the position of the addressee, the son, or the collective men who are being addressed here. She wants to cultivate a relationship with us, so she's encouraging us to do it now rather than later, because later will be too late. Now, it's very interesting how the book of Proverbs is set up, because as you read through the first few chapters, it comes to a culmination in chapter 9. Chapter 9, which is the chapter just before you get to the Proverbs per se, chapter 9 calls on the reader to make a choice. Let's turn to 9. And first I'll read verses 1 through 6. Wisdom has built her house. She has set up its 7 pillars. She has prepared her meat and mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her servants, and she calls from the highest point of the city. Let all who are simple come to my house. To those who have no sense, she says, come, eat my food and drink the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and you will live. Walk in the way of insight. Okay, so a woman, wisdom, has prepared a banquet and she's inviting us in for a meal. Now, even today, if you invite somebody over for a meal, you are inviting them into relationship, into a deeper relationship. And especially, you know, if a woman and a man get together for dinner, it has even more profound implications. She wants to become part and parcel of our lives. And in the ancient Near East, this is only magnified 100-fold. That is the significance of being invited to a meal. But before we have an opportunity to respond, we get a second invitation. We're very popular. All right, take a look at verses 13 to 18. Folly is an unruly woman. Now, this is the first time folly has been personified as a woman. She's simple and knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house on a seat at the highest point of the city, calling out to those who pass by, to go straight on their way. Let all who are simple come to my house. You see, she's inviting the same people over as woman wisdom. To those who have no sense, she says, stolen water is sweet, food eaten in secret is delicious. But little do they know, the narrator says, that the dead are there, that her guests are deep in the realm of the dead. So her meal looks delectable. Her meal looks delicious. But if we go over there to eat with her, I always think of that movie, I Married an Axe Murderer. You know, she'll chop us up and bury us in her basement. So here's our choice. Do we dine with woman wisdom or do we dine with woman folly? Again, who are these women? Let's turn to chapter 8, and we won't be able to give it the time it deserves. I'll come back to it at the end. But here's a chapter of great significance, and also a chapter that has had an interesting history of interpretation. And you have to be very careful how you interpret it, as I'll point out later. Does not wisdom call out? Does not understanding raise her voice? At the highest point along the way where the paths meet, she takes her stand beside the gate leading into the city. At the entrance, she cries aloud, to you, O people, I call out. I raise my voice to all mankind. You who are simple, gain prudence. You who are foolish, set your hearts on it. Listen, for I have trustworthy things to say. I open my lips to speak what is right. My mouth speaks what is true, for my lips detest wickedness. All the words of my mouth are just. None of them is crooked or perverse. To the discerning, all of them are right. They are upright to those who have found knowledge. Choose my instruction instead of silver, knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is more precious than rubies, and nothing you desire can compare with her. I, wisdom, dwell together with prudence. I possess knowledge and discretion. To fear the Lord is to hate evil. I hate pride and arrogance, evil behavior, and perverse speech. Counsel and sound judgment are mine. I have insight. I have power. By me, kings reign. I want you to remember verses 15 and 16 in particular for later. By me, kings reign, and rulers issue decrees that are just. By me, princes govern, and nobles, all who rule on earth. I love those who love me, and those who seek me find me. With me are riches and honor, enduring wealth and prosperity. My fruit is better than fine gold. What I yield surpasses choice silver. I walk in the way of righteousness, along the paths of justice, bestowing a rich inheritance on those who love me and making their treasuries full. Now, verses 22 and following are particularly interesting because they describe woman wisdom's relationship to creation. And I also want you to remember these passages for later, too. The Lord brought me forth as the first of his works, before his deeds of old. I was formed long ages ago at the very beginning when the world came to be. When there were no watery depths, I was given birth. When there were no springs overflowing with water. Before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills I was given birth. Before he made the world or its fields, or any of the dust of the earth. I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep. When he established the clouds above and fixed securely the fountains of the deep. When he gave the sea its boundaries so the waters would not overstep his command. And when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was constantly at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in the whole world, and delighting in mankind. So woman wisdom is both an observer of the creation, as well as, I would argue, based on verse 30, a participant. Because I would translate that, then I was the craftsman at his side. So she's the observer and the participant in creation. The subliminal message here, the implicit message, is this is a woman you need to know. She knows how the world works. And so coming into a relationship with her will help you navigate life. Now there's going to be more to it than that, but we'll just have to hold on. Now then, my children, listen to me. Blessed are those who keep my ways. Listen to my instruction and be wise. Do not disregard it. Blessed are those who listen to me, watching daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway. For those who find me find life and receive favor from the Lord. But those who fail to find me harm themselves. All who hate me love death. Okay, so again now, who are these women? As we answer that question, I want to draw your attention to the many times her place is described as on the high place, the highest point of the city. What building in ancient Israel or in the ancient Near East in general would be found on the highest place in the city?
The temple.
The temple. That's exactly right. Who is woman wisdom? Well, woman wisdom is a personification of Yahweh's attribute of wisdom, and ultimately stands for Yahweh himself. But notice, woman folly's house is also on the highest point in the city. It's also associated with temple language. So who is woman folly? Woman folly stands for the false gods and goddesses that are rivals to Israel's affections, gods like Baal and Marduk, Ishtar, Asherah, and so forth. So to the ancient reader, this is a call to enter into a deep and rich relationship with Yahweh and reject the consequences of death that come with a relationship with a false god. Now, let's leave it here in the Old Testament for a while. I'll come back and talk about, like I mentioned last night, you always need to come back and talk about how do we read these books as Christians. And, you know, we're not faced with this same dilemma. We're not really tempted to worship Baal. or Marduk or something like that. But I do want to point out a few things before we come to the New Testament, and that has to do with what are the implications of what I've been talking about in Proverbs 1 through 9 for how we read Proverbs 10 and following. First of all, we have a temptation more than any other place in the Bible to proof text from Proverbs 10 and following, and that is kind of sort of cherry-pick out of context good pieces of advice. I mean, take a look at Proverbs 10, 1. A wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son brings grief to his mother. I'll also focus in on verse 4. Lazy hands make for poverty, but diligent hands bring wealth. So, especially verse 4, but also verse 1, if you just isolate them from the context, they seem like just so much good advice, but really with not a lot of theological significance. But if you read it within the context of Proverbs 1 through 9, they're deeply theological. What Proverbs 10, 1 is saying is, if you bring joy to your parents, then you are wise, which means that you are acting like a proper worshiper of the true God. But if you bring grief to your parents, then you're acting like a worshiper of Baal or some other idol. Lazy hands are soon poor. Hard workers get rich, okay? Now, again, reading it from the perspective of Proverbs 1 through 9, laziness is obviously being associated with folly. So if you're lazy, it's not just, yeah, you're living life poorly. It's you're acting like an idolater. But if you're a hard worker, then you're acting like a proper worshiper of Yahweh. So you need to always bear in mind the lesson of Proverbs 1 through 9 when you're reading the rest of Proverbs as well. Now, as we turn to Proverbs 10 and following further, I'm going to make two points. Proverbs are not always true, and Proverbs don't make promises. Actually, you should burn this after I might just tell. Proverbs aren't always true. No, that's absolutely critical to understand. Proverbs are not always true. They do not intend to be always true. This raises the very important concept of genre. You have to know what type of literature you're reading and what type of truth claims some passage of scripture is making. The Bible isn't all one type of literature. It's a collection of books written in different genres. And it's really important to come to understand that because, you see, genre triggers reading strategy. We'll see that's real important tomorrow when we talk about the Song of Songs. Is it love poetry, or is it talking about our relationship with God in some kind of allegorical fashion? Proverbs aren't always true. That's just true of the proverb. Think about it. Well, let me give you an anecdote. My grandmother, when I was growing up in Columbus, Ohio, my grandmother was one of those people who just constantly used proverbs in her speech. And I remember it very fondly, probably because when I went to visit her, she would give me Crispies when I got there. Crispies were fresh dollar bills. She'd hand me a wad. My grandfather was a CEO of a bank, so she'd only use money never used by anybody else before. So, I love that memory. And the tickets to the Ohio State football game on the 50-yard line he had. So, thank you, Stanford, for beating Oregon State, giving Ohio State a chance to edge up to the national championship. So, all right, enough of that. I'm getting in trouble. All right, so... So when we'd go down there for Thanksgiving, I remember my mother and my aunt would come into the kitchen and they'd say, "Mom, we'll help you cook the turkey." And she greeted them with, "Too many cooks spoil the broth." Too many cooks spoil broth, which means get out of my kitchen, I'm doing it my way. But after dinner, when, you know, there were like 15 of us and the china was piled up to the ceilings, she'd come bustling into the room and go, "Many hands make light work." It is all of you get in the kitchen to help me wash these dishes. And I couldn't stand up and say, "Grandma, you just uttered the unchangeable principle of many hands, oh, too many cooks spoil the broth." No, because you see, she spoke the right word at the right time. That's what makes a proverb true. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 4. "Answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him yourself." Followed in the very next verse by, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly." So it's answer a fool according to his folly, or he'll be wise in his own eyes. Do not answer a fool, or you'll be like him. And you want to, your first response is, "Well, thanks for the advice." But you see, what the Proverbs are calling on us to do is to become observers, to learn from our experience, to learn from our mistakes, and be able to read people as well as the text. It's not just good enough to learn the Proverbs. You have to become kind of an astute reader of people and situations to know when it is proper to answer a fool. Maybe there's somebody in the around that will benefit from the interaction, but sometimes you don't answer a fool because you just get dragged into a vain, energy-sapping situation. So we have to learn how to read situations and learn from our mistakes. These are all really big themes in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs are not always true. And then secondly, another common mistake is to treat Proverbs as if they are giving promises. Treat Proverbs as if they are giving promises. Before I go there, let me go back to Proverbs 10:1 with the idea that Proverbs aren't always true. Because even when they're not giving advice, even when they're making an observation, they're not always true either. "A wise child brings joy to his parents. A foolish child brings grief to a mother, father, mother." So that's not always true either. You see, that proverb presupposes that your parents are godly and they want you to go in a godly direction. If you have a parent who's abusing you, you don't work to their happiness. It depends on the parent. The proverb, again, is presupposing godly parents. Now let's, with the second principle, Proverbs don't give promises. Let's consider verse 4. "Lazy hands are soon poor, hard workers get rich." Tell that to Paris Hilton. Okay. Even some of you don't know who Paris Hilton is. I think she's getting a little passé, that's the right word. But in any case, Paris Hilton, even if she didn't manufacture a television career, would have been fabulously wealthy, even though she was notoriously lazy. Why? Because her grandfather founded the Hilton hotel chain. But you see, Paris Hilton's experience does not render Proverbs 10 verse 4 wrong. Proverbs are giving us snapshots. They are saying, this is true, all other things being equal. 99.9% of us, if we're going to our jobs and we're lazy, we show up late, we don't do our tasks, we're going to get fired. But if we go in and we work hard, usually, not always, I'll have a proverb that'll give a counterexample to this. you'll do okay in your job, and you'll get paid, and you'll be able to support yourself. Let me illustrate this with one other well-known and often abused passage from the book of Proverbs. And that's the proverb, I think it's 22:6. "Train up a child in the way he should go, And when he grows old, he will not depart from it. So that is commonly used to encourage us parents whose children go astray. But I would argue that that is a wrong use of the proverb if it's treated as a promise. It's not a promise. First of all, it's a question of how to translate it, too. What the Hebrew literally says is, train up a child in his way, and when he grows old, he will not depart from it. So there is some question as to whether the his way is the child's way or God's way. My friend Dan Allender, with whom I often write books, he wrote a very good book on raising children called How Children Raise Their Parents. But when he used this verse, I told him, you should have asked me. Because he takes that interpretation. But even though, in my opinion, he misunderstood the proverb, he still gives really good advice, which is you got to be aware of the type of child that you have. I mean, my oldest child, Tremper 4, I should have spanked more. And my middle son, Tim, I didn't have to. All I have to do is look at him, and he'd change his behavior. So you have to know your child and know how to discipline them, how to treat them. But I do think that the traditional interpretation, train up a child in the way he should go, which presupposes that the way is God's way, and when he grows old, he won't depart from it. It's not a promise. It is saying, you as a parent, this is your responsibility. This is, if you don't do this, it's much, 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 much more likely your child will go astray. But it's not making a promise that if you do this even as diligently as any human being can do, that they won't fall in with the bad crowd and go in a different direction or something bad will happen. So we have to understand what the proverbs are. Now, you might say, well, great, Tremper, you just removed that promise from me. On the other hand, those proverbs, when they're treated as promises, are also used another way, which is behind your back, people are saying, yeah, their kid's in jail. They must not have raised them in the right way. So it can also be used, as Job's three friends do. You see, this, as we'll see tonight, is the problem with Job's three friends. They're treating the proverbs as if they are promises. And they're looking at Job and they're saying, you're sick. You're covered from head to foot with skin disease. You've lost your children. You've lost everything. You must be a horrible sinner. So you see, that's the danger of treating the proverbs as if they're promises. But we must never lose sight of the fact that they are helpful guides to living. Now, as such, I encourage you, the reason why I'm teaching this is to encourage you to explore the book of Proverbs in order to see how the book of Proverbs wants you to navigate life. And that's why I've given you this handout to take home. I've written a commentary on the book of Proverbs. I've written a commentary on all the wisdom books. I didn't bring my Proverbs commentary because it's too heavy. but when as I was going through Proverbs, I thought that, you know, the way the Proverbs are not organized, and intentionally so, they're not organized in a systematic way where, say, all the proverbs about money can be found in chapters 13 and 14, and all the proverbs about authority, how to deal with authorities in your life, are in chapter 17. And, you know, speech is treated in these three chapters. And I think the reason why is because that Proverbs reflects the chaos of life. It doesn't want to give the feel of a self-help book. But I still thought it was helpful to be able to organize all of the Proverbs on a particular topic. And so what I've given you is a list of passages within the book of Proverbs on various topics, table manners, alcohol, family relationships, speech on the next page, etc., etc., physical discipline. And by the way, it's really important when it comes to the teaching about the rod in the book of Proverbs to remember that these, you know, they're not telling you you have to use physical discipline on a child. I've run into people I remember being with a couple during dinner that any slight infraction that their four-year-old do, they felt that they had to obey Proverbs and spank them lightly, but still, the child was already changing behavior. It was just, I think, a horrible application of this particular text. But you could look through this list of topics, women and wife, children, etc., etc., and you might find them helpful as you work through them together. You can also go the next step and buy my commentary, and you can see then I have an essay on each of these topics I have to market my books, okay? So, but I thought just as a, just to give you a little bit of an example, I thought, and I have this listed on your outline, that as I searched the book of Proverbs for its teaching about money, I came up with the following major topics, and I just thought I'd briefly share this with you. Also to show you that no one proverb captures all the book's teaching on money. And indeed, that's a mistake that some people make, because they only, when they think of the book of Proverbs and money, they'll often only think of passages connected with the first topic, which is God blesses the righteous with wealth. And indeed, there are a number of texts that do teach that. Chapter 3, verses 9-10. Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops, then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. Now, you know, one of the biggest wrong teachings going around the church today is called the prosperity gospel. And you see, it's passages like this that become the grist for a prosperity gospel, that if you are wise, if you are godly, if you're faithful, then God will bless you with money. Now, that leads many people to kind of shy away from the idea in total. But you see, again, it's not making promises like the prosperity gospel often seems to imply. It does, the sister teaching with that is that foolish behavior leads to poverty. So chapter 6, verse 11 and following says, I'll start in verse 9. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? Okay, so that's foolish behavior, laziness. When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a thief, and scarcity like an armed man. On the other hand, and then there's also teaching, the wealth of fools will not last or help with what's important. Now, you see, that teaching recognizes that sometimes fools do have money. But what it's saying is it really won't help for what's most important in life. Chapter 13, verse 11 says, dishonest money dwindles away, but whoever gathers money little by little makes it grow. There's also an interesting passage in chapter 23. We'll which says, let's see, where is that? It basically says, this print's too small for my aging eyes. Well, it's the passage that says, you know, don't work too hard for money. Because if you work too hard, you're going to exhaust yourself, and it isn't really that important anyway, and eventually it's going to fly away like a goose.
Verses 4 to 6.
Thank you. That's probably it. Yeah, thanks. And actually, it's like a bird, because it's interesting that that passage has an Egyptian analog in the instructions of Amen Amope, which are older, which shows that the Israelite sage is knowledgeable of Egyptian wisdom and using it when it's applicable, which is interesting because the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Well, these Egyptian guys don't fear the Lord, but the Israelite sages are aware that even non-believers can stumble across a truth based on their observations. But they would, I would argue, would come back and say, well, ultimately the Egyptian is not wise because he doesn't really believe the most fundamental and most important thing about the universe. That the Israelites read and understood Egyptian literature and valued it is clear from 1 Kings 4 when the book of Kings says about Solomon's wisdom that it's even greater than the wisdom of Egypt. So Solomon's wisdom is greater than the wisdom of Egypt, which if you think about it, if that's a compliment, which it is, means that Egyptian wisdom is pretty amazing, but Solomon's far surpasses it. All right, now, poverty isn't always the result of laziness or other foolish issues. Proverbs more than acknowledges that poverty is the result of injustice and oppression in a passage like 13:23. So to use Proverbs to say, oh, that person's poor, they must be foolish, is totally illegitimate. 13:23 says, an unplowed field produces food for the poor, but injustice sweeps it away. It doesn't name the injustice, and often the Proverbs are vague as to what kind of injustice that might be. The Hebrew word might even apply, a storm comes and takes the crops away. It might mean an unjust bureaucrat comes and taxes them too much, or whatever. Now also, Proverbs teaches that wisdom is better than wealth. Chapter 15, verse 6. Let's see. Well, let's do 15, 17. Better a small serving of vegetables with love than a fattened calf with hatred. I remember how the Old Living Bible rendered that. Better salad with people you love than a steak with people that you're in conflict with. Now notice that these so-called better than proverbs, there are a whole series of better than proverbs, show you that wisdom doesn't come automatically with wealth, that often you have to make a choice between wisdom and wealth. So the teaching of these better than proverbs is always choose wisdom. And then finally, wisdom has limited value. 13:8. I love this proverb. A person's riches may ransom their life, but the poor cannot respond to threatening rebukes. Actually, I wish I had my translation. That's a little unclear. What it's saying is, if you're rich and you get kidnapped or somebody gets kidnapped, you got the money to ransom them. No one ever kidnaps somebody who's poor. You don't have to worry about it. But perhaps one of the most interesting passages on wealth in the Bible is found in at the end here in chapter 30. beginning in verse 7. Two things I ask of you, Lord, do not refuse me before I die. Keep falsehood and lies far away from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. So I think this is an interesting passage. I don't think this condemns the rich at all, but it acknowledges that some people can't handle wealth and still stay devoted to the Lord, still maintain the generosity, which Proverbs also tells those with money to demonstrate. But those who are too poor might be tempted to steal just to survive. So this is the great middle class passage in the book of Proverbs. Give me just enough, but not too much, not too little. Well, again, that's just a taste. There are a lot of other passages that you could look at and reflect on your own situation and think about your own heart as you deal with money. Okay, so one final point. Jesus and woman wisdom. Jesus and woman wisdom. How do we read the book of Proverbs from a New Testament perspective, particularly when it comes to this choice between woman wisdom and woman folly? Well, as you read the New Testament, you can't miss the fact that the New Testament puts a big emphasis on Christ's wisdom. Even in the infancy narrative in Luke, at the end of chapter 2, on two occasions it says, Jesus grew in stature and in wisdom. And the one story we have of him as a young man is when his parents leave him behind in the temple, the left behind story of the New Testament. And when they come back, he's confounding the rabbis. He's a person of prodigious wisdom. When he begins to teach, he teaches like no one has ever heard before. And he teaches by the use of parables. Now that's very significant because you see, the parable was the teaching tool of the sage or the wise man. He didn't invent the parable. Parables were used by sages. Indeed, the Greek word parable, parabole, easy one to remember, is translated into Hebrew by the term mashal, which means proverb. So he's teaching proverbs, parables, to the people. He is the ultimate sage, just like he's the ultimate priest, the ultimate king, and the ultimate prophet. Paul in Colossians 2, verse 3, calls him the treasure of God's wisdom. He's the incarnation of God's wisdom. But what's really interesting is how the New Testament associates Jesus with woman wisdom. Now, I'm going to underline that term associates with, not identifies as. In Matthew chapter 11, when the Jewish leaders are giving him a hard time about eating and drinking, he says, well, you gave John the Baptist a hard time for not doing it, and me a hard time for doing it. And then he says, wisdom will be proved right by her actions. It's very clear in the Greek. It's the feminine. He's associating himself with woman wisdom. Colossians chapter 1. Verse 15 and following. Now remember how woman wisdom is described in Proverbs 8 as won by me, princes reign. And also in terms of woman wisdom's involvement with creation. New Testament scholars see rightly, you know, allusions here in Colossians 1:15 back to Proverbs 8. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Remember that language in Proverbs 8. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers of authority, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So here Paul is using language from Proverbs 8 and the description of woman wisdom to refer to Jesus, as is John in his famous prologue in John chapter 1. John 1 is looking back, of course, to Genesis 1, but also through Proverbs 8 when John says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." So, again, it's an association, not an identification. Proverbs 8 is not a prophecy of Jesus. It's not a description of Jesus. If you treat it that way, and you treat it not like a poem, but as some kind of literal description, you'll be soon going down to the local Jehovah Witness or Mormon church, because that's how they interpret Proverbs 8 and John 1. That Jesus is literally the firstborn of creation. But that's not a proper use of Proverbs chapter 8. It's an association in order to tell us again that Jesus is the epitome of God's wisdom. And it does so in a poetic way. But what it also means is when we read Proverbs and we come to that decision between woman wisdom and woman folly, what we think of is Jesus Christ. It's encouraging us to enter into a deeper, richer relationship with Christ, to listen to his words, to receive his guidance in terms of how to live our lives, and to avoid whatever idols, not Baal and Marduk, but as we talked about last night, maybe it's our work, maybe it's money, maybe it's a relationship with a spouse or a parent or something like that, whatever threatens to become number one in our life. So my hope this morning is that I've given you an orientation to the book of Proverbs, and I hope that the book intrigues you enough that you'll start exploring it with regard to these various topics. Let's close with prayer. Lord, we thank you for the gift of the book of Proverbs to help us live our lives, to point us to you, to point us to your Son, Jesus Christ, who is the incarnation of your wisdom. Lord, give us the strength, give us the spirit, so we can follow in your way of wisdom. In Christ's name, amen.